From NPR and Futuro Media, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, a conversation with Democratic presidential candidate Beto O'Rourke. So it is now 9:57 in El Paso, and we are in a funeral home. It's been a bit over a month since we went to El Paso to listen to the citizens of that border city after a gunman shot and killed 22 people and injured 24 others at a local Walmart. It was known as the Mexican Walmart.
That morning was a normal, a happy day for everybody, but in 1 second, your life can change. It's very painful to see my father 48 hours fighting in the hospital. He fight and he lost the battle.
The shooting in El Paso marked a turning point for Latinos and Latinas in this country. The alleged assassin said that he wanted to shoot as many Mexicans as he could. It's also become a key moment for the people who live in that city.
I am incredibly saddened, and it is very hard to think about this. But I'll tell you, El Paso is the strongest place in the world.
And one of them happens to be running for president. And in the wake of the tragedy, he didn't stay quiet.
You know the shit he's been saying? He's been calling Mexican immigrants rapists and criminals. I don't know, like, members of the press, what the f***? Hold on a second.
We've got to acknowledge the hatred, the open racism that we're seeing. There's an environment of it in the United States. We see it on Fox News. We see it on the internet. But we also see it from our commander in chief. And he is encouraging this. He doesn't just tolerate it. He encourages it.
Although you surely know him as Beto, he was born Robert Francis O'Rourke, and he represented El Paso in the U.S. Congress from 2013 to 2019. And before that, he was a member of the El Paso City Council. He grew up in the city, and he's deeply connected to the border community there.
Our next Senator of the United States, Beto O'Rourke.
Nationally, Beto came to people's attention after he was considered something of an overnight sensation in Texas when he decided to run against one of the most well-known Republican incumbents in the United States Senate, Ted Cruz.
Senator Cruz is not going to be honest with you. He's going to make up positions and votes that I've never held or have ever taken. He's dishonest.
Congressman O'Rourke not only opposes a wall, but he has said we have too many fences and walls already on the border. He wants to tear down the ones we have. And I'll note, he brought up El Paso.
Beto O'Rourke was very innovative in his use of social media and gearing up with a successful grassroots organizing team. But still, he lost the election to Ted Cruz. He obtained 48% of the vote, though, and that set a record for the most votes ever cast for a Democrat in the history of Texas.
I'm as hopeful as I have ever been in my life, and tonight's loss does nothing to diminish the way that I feel about Texas or this country.
All of that national buzz created by Beto and his run for the U.S. Senate turned into rumors of him running for president. And of course,
Amy and I are happy to share with you that I'm running to serve you as the next president of the United States of America.
On March 14th of this year, he announced,
"This is a defining moment of truth for this country and for every single one of us."
In his campaign, Beto has become one of the most vocal critics of President Trump.
The invitation to hate openly, unapologetically, to call Mexican immigrants rapists and criminals, to call asylum seekers animals, an infestation, to describe white nationalists, Klansmen, neo-Nazis as very fine people, that has certainly contributed to the environment that we see in this country at this moment.
Beto's presidential campaign hasn't caught on fire the same way his run for Senate did. But he was just on the debate stage for the third Democratic presidential debate this past Thursday, featuring the top 10 candidates. And since the tragic shooting in El Paso, Beto has been more vocal than ever before.
You may call a cockroach an infestation. You may use that word in the Third Reich to describe those who are undesirable, who must be put down because they are subhuman. You do not expect to hear that in the United States of America, in this age, in our generation.
I sat down with Beto O'Rourke just days before the most recent Democratic debate, and we had a conversation about El Paso, the border, punk music, his upbringing, and why he's running for the presidency. We started our conversation by talking about that tragic shooting in El Paso.
You know, I have for so long been talking about how dangerous Donald Trump's rhetoric is, describing Mexican immigrants as rapists and criminals, and those asylum seekers as an infestation or animals or predators or killers. Those are all words that he's used. And I've, you know, told anyone who will listen, you know, it doesn't just offend us. It will change us. And I give examples of the mosque in Victoria, Texas, that was burned to the ground within 24 hours of his signing an executive order attempting to ban Muslim travel, or the rise in hate crimes. But there was no way for me to even imagine that it could manifest itself in this way, that someone echoing the president's words, he used invasion in his manifesto and his fear of being replaced as a white majority by Hispanics, literally said that, told police afterwards he came to kill Mexicans, drove 600 miles with an AK-47, a weapon that he ordered that was designed originally for use on a battlefield, and killed 22 people because of their ethnicity, because of their presumed immigration status or country of national origin. It was not only a hate crime, it was an act of domestic terrorism, and it was perpetrated by a white supremacist. And it is not unique, unfortunately. We know from listening to Christopher Wray, the director of the FBI, that the majority of domestic terror cases he's investigating right now involve white supremacists. It is on the rise. It's always been a defining feature of our country going back 400 years, but it has now been brought out into the open by this president to great risk to our fellow Americans. And I know from listening to your reporting, and I know from my own experiences in El Paso, so many Latinos in our community feel like they have a target on their back right now. Mariachi, who came up and she said, "Do you remember me, Beto? I played at one of your events," and it's an all-female mariachi group. And I said, "I do remember, and tell me how you all are doing. Have you lost anybody in this?" And she said, "No, my family's okay, but we don't want to perform anymore because we are so identified with Mexican and Mexican-American culture. And to be that symbol and then to be out in public just does not feel safe anymore." So that's where we are as a country.
You know, you bring up mariachi, and actually, I came back from El Paso, and there is a park party happening in Harlem. And the police suddenly, and it's a Latino-Dominican park party, lots of music, lots of grilling. Police come up on it, you know, with sirens and spotlights and flashlights. And I said to the police officer, like, this was unnecessary. You know, people right now here in New York are thinking about what just happened in El Paso. This police officer looked at me and he was like, what does New York City have to do with El Paso? Mm.
I love that you are making this connection clear between El Paso and New York, or El Paso, and as we saw, Mississippi, site of the largest single state workplace raid. More than 600 ICE agents come in to that state, apprehend nearly 700 people, many of whom have been in the country for 15, 20, 25 years, working in chicken processing plants in little towns like Canton and Forest, Mississippi, for $8, $8.50, maybe if they've been there for a long time, $12 an hour, raising their U.S. citizen children, contributing to the success of their community, of our country, giving far more than they ever take, and treated almost like animals. You know, their wrists tied during the enforcement raid, the ICE agents coming in with guns drawn, body armor on, tasing somebody who actually turned out to be a U.S. citizen who was working there. But it wouldn't matter. You shouldn't do that to anybody who's just trying to earn a living, has posed no threat, committed no crime, perpetrated no violence. And there was this one woman who came up to us in this little tiendita where we had a ad hoc town hall meeting with those who had not been apprehended and were not detained. And she said, you know, there are all these people who are talking about how we're a burden, we immigrants are a burden on our communities and our country. I've never taken a single benefit, a single handout. I don't want one. In fact, I just want to work, but now you've taken away my job. And perversely, ironically, now I need help to pay the rent. Those kinds of workplace raids are up tenfold under the Donald Trump administration. So it's not just the walls
or the kids in cages, or the 7 children whose lives we've lost just in the last year who are in our care and custody. It wasn't just the Walmart shooting where 22 people were killed, dozens more injured. It's not just the rhetoric. It is the fact that whether you're in Mississippi or New York or Indiana or anywhere in this country and you're an immigrant, you suddenly wonder whether you're going to be attacked or violence is going to be used against you. Or as we've heard from so many beautiful children in El Paso who are born in this country but are Mexican American, they ask, why does my president not like me?
So there really doesn't feel like there is a border between El Paso and Juarez. I mean, sister cities. How does this place inform who you are as a candidate who wants to be president? How does this dynamic border reality that a lot of people do not understand?
Yeah.
Because they just think of helicopters
right.
and border agents and militarization. It's not that.
It's the most beautiful place on the planet, as far as I'm concerned. You're in the Chihuahuan Desert at the foot of the Rocky Mountains in this little river valley defined by the Rio Grande River that ends up joining and not separating these two communities. And sometimes people think about sister cities as, some kind of abstraction. These two sister cities are like twins, like almost like conjoined twins. And you know this from being there. Downtown Ciudad Juarez and downtown El Paso, the street grids run into each other. Those bridges connect families and history and culture and the economy. $80 billion in U.S.-Mexico trade crosses every year. 32 million crossings. Going over to the Kentucky Club to have a drink or going over to work as a manager in a maquila or somebody from Ciudad Juarez going to the University of Texas at El Paso and studying in Dr. Bixler's Chicano Studies class, for example. That defines us in this profoundly beautiful way. My wife wasn't from El Paso, was coming back from a year teaching in Guatemala. We got set up on a blind date. I took her over to Juarez on that first date to eat at Martino's, to go to the Kentucky Club, but also to walk down Avenida Juarez and go to the customs house where the first time that a president of the United States and the president of Mexico ever met, it was in 1909, and it was there. It was Taft and Diaz, and neither of them needed a translator because each of them spoke both English and Spanish. We went to the Mission of Guadalupe that's been there for 330 years, and we just took it all in. It's beautiful. I want everyone to see it.
Dude, that was your first date?
And we're married, so it worked 14 years later. So that's my free advice to anybody in the border region. You asked how it informs who I am and what I do. It is all of me. I'm defined by that city in which I was raised, where Amy and I are raising Ulysses, Molly, and Henry. And we're so proud of it. And the people of El Paso and Juarez are so proud.
What was it that you said to the journalist who was asking you questions about Donald Trump in the post-El Paso shooting exactly? I think it involved a word that begins with the letter F.
Yeah,
You said...
I said, what the f***? She was asking me a question, something along the lines of, do you think the president is racist? How can that be up for debate or even asked by a credible journalist in the year 2019?
I mean, your response was frankly... It was refreshing because the truth is you're frustrated as a politician, but also as a human being, which is why are we playing a kind of game here?
Right.
And your exasperation, I think that's one of the things that you really do connect with people. It's like, okay, there's Beto. He just said that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think all of us to some degree, including politicians and members of the press, have been blinded by how bizarre this president is or how un-American this language is to ask people, women of color, duly elected by their constituents in Congress, to go back to their country or to try to make us afraid of asylum seekers who arrive here as desperate and as vulnerable and as defenseless as a human being can be, to have kids sleeping on concrete floors without even giving them diapers, soiling themselves and sleeping in their filth. It makes us ashamed and embarrassed, and it is almost so obscene, we have a hard time calling it out, and we fall into the same practices and rituals. Do you think the president is this, or could it have anything to do with what he said, what happened here in El Paso? And as an El Pasoan who was seeing the aftermath of this, I was so exasperated, so frustrated, and I just, I couldn't take it anymore. And I remember I got in the van after that interview, and I told Amy, my wife, I said, you know what, I think... I really made a big mistake there. I shouldn't have allowed my emotions to get the better of me, and I should not have said that.
But I couldn't help it. It just came out of me. And, you know, in the end, I think it
did.
And
what did Amy say?
She looked at me like, she had not heard it at the time. I told her in the van and she looked at me like, you know, maybe you did mess up there. But I think everyone in El Paso and Juarez is so emotional, so distraught, so angry.
Coming up on Latino USA, we continue our conversation with Democratic presidential candidate Beto O'Rourke. We talk about his run for president and why he stays in the race.
I want to be president, and I want to serve this country and be the leader that we need right now, but that we're missing right now.
Stay with us. No te vayas.
There is no way of getting around it. College is really expensive.
She was like, I have to go here. I'm just going to die if I don't go. And then we looked at the cost. I said, well, you're just going to have to die.
But there are strategies to help ease the burden. Check out Life Kit's new episode from NPR on saving for college by subscribing to Life Kit All Guides.
Hey, we're back, and we're going to continue now with our conversation with Beto O'Rourke, who is running for president in the Democratic Party. I didn't know that, actually, that you played in a rock and roll band.
Punk rock or rock and roll, yeah.
Punk rocky.
Yeah.
And it makes me think about this other side of Beto, right, which is a side that I didn't know, actually. So, yeah, you're born in El Paso. Your family there is a well-known, politically connected family. I find it interesting that you leave to go to the Woodbury Forest Boys School, which is like a very elite school for boys from 1889. Then you end up going from high school there to Columbia University. And I just want to know about that space there. You know, it was actually at Columbia when you're playing in the punk band and you kind of almost, that was going to be one of your, or a career.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I wanted nothing more. I mean, you know, the Clash changed my life hearing London Calling, and it was so unlike anything that was on the radio, anything I'd ever heard except for the Beatles and these foundations of rock and roll, even Buddy Holly, there's some rockabilly on that record. And then going to my first punk rock show in El Paso. And
which was what band?
Well, the first big band that came through was the Adolescents from Southern California.
By the way, El Paso's like got a serious punk rock.
Oh, absolutely. Punk rock, some punk rock heroes. So the Plugs, Mexican-American punk rock band, they were featured on the Repo Man soundtrack. They backed up Bob Dylan when he played Joker Man on the David Letterman show in the early 80s. We were fiercely proud of them. The Rhythm Pigs, that came out of El Paso. Khalid, who is not punk rock, but is,
are you serious, Khalid?
Very young man who came out of El Paso and used that city's experiences to inform his music. So when we're campaigning and we are free of, and we don't always do this, right? But when we're free of the conventions of today's politics and the corporate nature of today's politics, and we're just connecting with people in Williamson, Iowa, or Bland County, Virginia, or wherever we are, especially those places that aren't visited, whose stories are not often told or heard, that to me feels very punk rock and very much in keeping with what's exciting to me about life and exciting about being on the road in the first place.
Hmm. So now talk to me a little bit more about the Robert Francis, which is the name that you were born with, that was at that pretty preppy boys' school and then at Columbia. Like, were you Beto at Columbia? Did people call you Beto there?
They called me Beto when they found out that my family and all my friends in El Paso called me Beto. No, I very consciously, when I left El Paso, wanting to go to another part of the world, explore something different, and to some degree get out of my household and our family dynamic there. I had a very strong-willed
big personality, gregarious dad, and felt like to some degree I was overwhelmed in his shadow and wanted to get out. And I also think, like perhaps a lot of young people, I could in some ways reinvent myself, and I'd be Robert now instead of Beto. Beto is a nickname. It's you know, folks in the East Coast aren't going to understand that. And same at Columbia. But as soon as my friends that I'd made in New York learned that my mom called me Beto or my friends called me Beto, then they would as well. And then I learned to embrace that. And moving back to El Paso in 1998, I'd graduated from Columbia in 95, lived in Brooklyn, worked in the city for a few years, moved back. And I just realized that I had grown up in this embarrassment of riches that I'd never really understood until I left it and came back to it and gladly embraced my name being Beto and our heritage in El Paso. And just something that I'm so proud of is this community that means so much, not just to our fellow El Pasoans, but to this country and who we are as Americans. And I wanted to tell that story. So that was a big turning point for me to come back to El Paso and just remember who it was that I was to begin with and where I came from.
You said an embarrassment of riches, and I wondered, was there a part of you, you know, you were from El Paso. Nobody knew. I mean, El Paso, people maybe didn't take you seriously because you were a Texan kid, you know.
Yeah.
Did you experience any of that?
Sure. I was intimidated when I came to Columbia. When I came to New York, was on financial aid, doing work study jobs, delivering the New York Times was one of my jobs Sunday mornings by hand truck in the Barnard dorms.
I love that. Wait, a guy delivering newspapers to the women of Barnard College.
Yes. Working, as a security guard at Ferris Booth Hall and different dormitories. And I came from a smaller town in a more remote community. And I just, you know, here were all these amazing, brilliant people who had these illustrious backgrounds. And yeah, there was a little bit of intimidation there for sure. But after I was in New York for a while, I realized New York is El Paso. These are cities of immigrants. These are people from all over the world who found a way to make it here, who chose us, who chose this country and made us so much better as a result.
So Beto, there are people who say, but Beto, look at your numbers. As a white man, with privilege, because you have a lot of privilege, class privilege, gender, race, heterosexuality, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And people are like, your numbers are just not that great. It shows a certain amount of, to use this term, white male hubris. So what makes you say, but I'm going to stay in? What's the narration going on in your head? Like, no, Beto, you got this. Like, keep going. Just
every race that I've ever run, for city council, for Congress, for U.S. Senate, we were counted out before we ever began. I mean, at the beginning of the Texas Senate race, my name ID in that state must have been close to 1 or 2%. And if we had just listened to the pollsters, we never would have run that race. I never would have won my seat in Congress where I served for 3 terms and did everything I could to represent El Paso because that race, we were told, was unwinnable, outspent 5-1 by the incumbent. Somebody just shared something today. They said at this point in the 2008 presidential election, Rudolph Giuliani was up 11 points. And we all know what the presidency of Rudolph Giuliani was like in this country. It is so hard to predict the winner or even the contenders this early in the process. But you ask another really important question that I want to make sure that I answer. I'm a white man who, by my race, my gender, the opportunities I've had from a family that lived comfortably, have enjoyed privileges that have been denied, actively denied, legally denied in some cases to others. With so many amazing candidates running right now, how could I continue to stand in this field? Here's my response. In a country of nearly 330 million, no one person, no one candidate in their person will exemplify or demonstrate the rich diversity of this country. Instead, we need someone who is intent upon going to communities to listen to people who very often have not been afforded a seat at the table and making sure that their stories become our stories in this campaign. Make sure that the composition of our campaign team, or if we are lucky enough to lead this country as president, our administration, reflects the diversity and the genius of this country.
So you did get more votes in Texas than any other Democrat has when you ran for Senate, but you didn't win. And I'm just wondering about this really profound love for Texas that I'm feeling from you and how you would respond to the question then of like, so why run for president of the United States?
Yeah.
Like, if you love Texas, why not do the Texas thing?
I want to be president, and I want to serve this country and be the leader that we need right now, but that we're missing right now. A president who heals instead of inflames, who unites us instead of divides us or drives us apart based on fear or anger or anxiety or paranoia, the language and the terms and the phrases that our current president uses. Someone who reflects our ambition, that we were meant to do great things. We're confident, we're bold, we're courageous. We're not fearful, we don't wall ourselves off, we don't put kids in cages. We don't talk about one another as though our differences are disqualifying or dangerous. I know from El Paso that our differences make us stronger and more successful and safer and more secure than we would be otherwise. And I want to provide that leadership for this country. I want to defeat Donald Trump because I know it is critically important for our ability to save ourselves as a country, much less do the ambitious things that need to happen. Universal health care, confronting climate change before it's too late, rewriting our immigration laws in our own image, ensuring this economy works for everyone. Before you can do any of that, you've got to make sure that he does not serve another 4 years. And what I've learned in Texas by winning more votes than any Democrat has ever won, by winning independents for the first time in decades, by winning Republicans in hundreds of thousands, is that it will be no one person, but a movement of people, people who are brought in, who are not excluded, who are not taken for granted, who are not counted out, that will defeat Donald Trump.
Let's talk a little bit about specificity in terms of policies. So I want to be clear about your position on decriminalizing border crossings. So just so people understand, for many, 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 many decades, crossing the border without papers, in fact, is a misdemeanor. Am I correct on that?
Yes.
It's a misdemeanor.
For 90 years, I believe it's been part of the criminal code in this country.
So Julian Castro, who is competing against you, has called for a repeal of Section 1325 of the Immigration Nationality Act. And that is the one that criminalizes the crossing?
That's right. But I want to correct an impression that some, including Secretary Castro, have left, which is that it is through this code that the president separates families or puts kids in cages or has lost the lives of seven children in our custody. The president has done that not through the criminal code, not through the civil code. He's done that through his own cruelty and the torture that he's visited on these kids. What we need to do is not only replace Donald Trump, not only rewrite Section 1325, and I co-sponsored legislation as a member of Congress to do that, so no family seeking asylum or refuge or shelter is ever criminally prosecuted or detained or separated. In fact, I would make as my priority reuniting every one of those separated families, but going well beyond that to rewrite our immigration laws comprehensively so that every green card holder is made a U.S. citizen as soon as possible because we waive citizenship fees. The nearly 10 million who are here undocumented, making this country great, contributing far more than they ever take, are legalized in this country. And especially Dreamers, who spent the majority of their lives here and are as American as anyone else, made U.S. citizens tomorrow. Going to Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, and addressing the reasons that people leave in the first place, reduce violence in those communities, address historic droughts that the people of Guatemala did not cause, nor was it caused by God or by Mother Nature. It was caused by the United States and other first world countries, our excesses and emissions, our inaction in the face of climate change. They are bearing the brunt of that, and they're doing what any human being would do in the face of that kind of adversity or violence. They're bringing their kids to safety and to shelter.
So, Beto, I just want to be clear. Have you said you want to tear down the wall? If I'm elected, I will tear down that wall. And, you know, then suddenly the Democrat is quoting the Republican,
right,
Ronald Reagan, tear down that wall.
Right. So the short answer is yes. I would, include all local stakeholders. There are more than 600 miles of wall and fencing and physical barriers now along that 2,000-mile border. And where they are not working, where, in fact, in El Paso, we saw crime actually go up after the wall was constructed instead of coming down. It made us less, not more safe. As an El Pasoan, I, for one, would want to take much of that wall down. If there are other places where a physical barrier from the community's perspective is necessary or helpful and it already exists, I would defer to them. And unfortunately, it's not just Republicans who've advocated and voting for building walls here. Democrats voted for the Secure Fence Act that provided the authorization and ultimately the funding to build the walls that we have. And one of the things that your listeners may or may not know about, but I think it's important to stress, is that those walls are not just offensive to those of us who live on the border and know that we live in very peaceful, beautiful binational communities, but they cause death and suffering. Nearly 10,000 people have died over the last 10 years as these walls have pushed them to ever more remote stretches of the southwestern desert, and they cause death and suffering, and we should be aware of that.
Would you do something bold, like we're going to stop all deportations at this point? There will be a halt on deportations. There'll be a halt. I mean, like, what bold actions are you prepared to say? I know that there's abolish ICE, and I'm not sure if you're signed on to that, but kind of what bold actions?
I would reserve internal immigration enforcement and deportations for any immigrant who poses a violent threat because they have used violence against their fellow Americans or their fellow family members or members of their community. I would never, as this president has done, and unfortunately other presidents have done, have a workplace raid like we've seen in Mississippi or in Texas or all across this country, terrorizing and terrifying families and entire communities who've done nothing wrong and pose no threat. And in fact, I think afford us extraordinary opportunity going forward if we only legalize their presence here and allow them to contribute even more than they already have.
When people say that you are categorized as a liberal progressive, but that in fact you are a little bit more to the center, how does that feel for you? When people are saying Beto O'Rourke is more of a centrist than some of the other candidates who are running?
You know, I think in 2019, that political spectrum no longer works. I mean, I want to end the prohibition on marijuana. I want to expunge the arrest records for those who've been arrested for possession of a substance that's legal in most states in this country. I don't know where that is on the political spectrum because I listen to Republicans who feel that same way. I want universal, guaranteed, high-quality health care. No copay for a mental health care visit, the ability for every woman to make her own decisions about her own body. I don't know where that is on the spectrum. It just makes sense to me, and I hear from my fellow Americans that that's what they want to see.
So finally, why should Latinos and Latinas specifically choose you?
I'm listening to Latinos and Latinas. I come from a proud community of immigrants and sons and daughters of immigrants. I'm proud of it. And it's a community whose story I tell all over this country, this fierce pride in who we are and what we've contributed to the success of the United States of America. The fact that we show up for one another as we did all across Texas, or as I'm doing all across this country, to listen to the stories of those who have labored, sometimes in the shadows, sometimes unrecognized, sometimes without being able to lift up their voice and engage in this national conversation, sometimes without having the ability to cast a vote and ensure that their will is reflected in the very government to whom they pay taxes, to the very country that they made great in the first place. And Maria, I think some of that is reflected in the results that we saw in Texas, where our share of the Latino, Latina vote was so much greater than what we saw in the 2014 midterm elections. And I think it was because we were very consciously going to communities that had been left out of the conversation and having those conversations in both English and in Spanish. And then sometimes English and Spanish at the same time, just as we do throughout El Paso. I'm so proud of the Hispanic and Latino and Chicano contribution to the success of this country. That's reflected in who I am, in my candidacy, in the work that I've done in public office, and that will be a cornerstone of my administration as president.
So, Rafas or Christostomos?
Christostomos.
Oh!
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. And then Chico's Tacos if you don't like either of those.
Ooh, all right, all right. Beto O'Rourke, thank you so much for speaking with us on Latino USA.
Thank you.
Beto O'Rourke served as a member of the U.S. House of Representatives and is now seeking the Democratic nomination for President of the United States. This episode was produced by Miguel Macias and edited by Fernanda Camarena. The Latino USA team includes Sofia Palizacá, Antonia Cerejido, Maggie Freeling, and Janice Yamoka, with help from Ginny Montalvo and Maya Cueva. Special thanks this week to Julio Ricardo Varela. Our engineers are Stephanie LeBeau and Julia Caruso. Our production manager is Natalia Fidelholtz. Our New York Women's Foundation Ignite Fellow is Fernanda Uriegas. Our theme music was composed by Zenia Rubinos. If you like the music you heard on this episode, be sure to stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again on our next episode. And in the meantime, I'll see you on social media. Ciao.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the New York Women's Foundation, funding women leaders that build solutions in their communities and celebrating 30 years of radical generosity. The Wincote Foundation. And the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
People who watch me on television, they look at me and they're like, why are you so short?
I get why are you so tall.
I'm Maria Hinojosa, and next time on Latino USA, haunting images of life in Honduras captured by photographer Tomas Ayuso in an attempt to humanize his people. That's next time on Latino USA.